This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Eller for the draw. And as the puck drops, the words that DC fans have been waiting to hear since 1974, the Washington Capitals are the 2018 Stanley Cup champions. It's not a dream. It's not a desert mirage. It's Lord Stanley, and he is coming to Washington.
John Walton with the call Thursday night. 2 months after it began, the Stanley Cup playoffs have come to an end. The Washington Capitals hoisting Lord Stanley's Cup in Las Vegas for the first time in franchise history. They win a dramatic Game 5 by a 4-3 margin. They win the Stanley Cup Final 4-1. The city of Washington, Stanley Cup champions. Good morning, Winnipeg. Good morning, Manitoba. For all those joining us live this morning via the iHeartRadio app and TSN1290.ca, we say good morning, universe, and welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by Dave Minuke and Ezra Ginsberg. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets news and audio is illegalcurve.com. You can, of course, also reach us here in studio. Send your text to 129090. Much like with Twitter, if we like what we read, we'll even potentially read it on air. Mr. Ginsberg, Mr. Minuke, I say good morning to you both.
Good morning.
It ended dramatically on Thursday night. It was certainly a very entertaining back-and-forth hockey game.
Does Ovechkin still have the cup?
I believe that
he's actually feeding Tiesto beer out of it right now at Hackison.
That was sort of your dream come true there, Dave.
Oh, 100%.
You know, you'd be at an EDM club with the Stanley Cup walking in. You know, I could see Dave Minuke taking a few sips of bubbly out of the Stanley Cup.
Oh, I'd be up on that dance floor with Tiesto, no question.
Dave and I were thinking of catching the red eye and maybe heading down to Vegas for a night, but we just didn't have time, so.
Well, you have a 2-week-old. So yeah. That, again, probably would have, you know, infringed on your plans
a little bit. What he's saying is I had time. He didn't have time.
Exactly. Anyways,
and I will never have time again.
Never again. Basically, just give it up at this point in time. So it was a tremendous Game 5, entertaining back and forth. And the Washington Capitals, the team known over the years for choking away opportunities, a team known for being a regular season juggernaut but always falling short in the playoffs, is no longer that team. The monkey, proverbial monkey off their back. They are Stanley Cup champions with a dominant performance against the Vegas Golden Knights. The Golden Knights, of course, win game one. But after that, it was just all Washington all the time, and the Golden Knights were game. They put up a good fight, but they did not have any answers for the Washington Capitals.
Yeah, Drew, I thought it was actually a pretty good Stanley Cup final. I realize that, you know, there are a lot of hockey fans out there that don't think it's a series unless it goes to 6 or 7 games. But if you think about it, game four was the only game that was a blowout, right? Mm-hmm. All other games in the series were close. And when you look at this game particularly, Game 5, the Capitals just weren't going to be denied. What a goal by Devontae Smith-Pelly. One of the nicest goals that we saw during these playoffs, but
falling through, it obviously isn't the same as the Bobby Orr goal, but you can see the parallels. You see, you know, in that he's flying through the ice and he's falling down as he tucks it around Marc-Andre Fleury. I mean, you're absolutely right. They were a team on a mission, the Washington Capitals were.
Absolutely. It was a really impressive goal by Smith-Pelly. He was really good in the Stanley Cup final. That fourth line for the Capitals was really good. Love Jay Beagle. So this Capitals team, I thought the game four, there were 6 different goal scorers for the Capitals.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that was very telling about this team because in years past, in the second round against the Pittsburgh Penguins, and I realize this is a cliche, Drew, and we talk about this all the time, but they really didn't get that depth scoring. They didn't get the scoring from the third and fourth lines. And you look at who scores the goal, the Stanley Cup winning goal, it's Lars Eller, your third line center, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that third line was excellent. Andrei Burakovsky, I thought, had an excellent playoffs. And I thought all series long, Lars Eller was excellent for them, especially when he had to move up when there was an injury to Evgeny Kuznetsov. So sure. I thought Eller was excellent, and there are so many great stories. I mean, Dave and I were talking about it right before we came on air. I mean, you have to be so happy for a guy like Barry Trotz from Dauphin, Manitoba. All of those years as the head coach of the Nashville Predators, they never get past the second round. He finally wins a Stanley Cup. I think he's one of the best coaches in the game. So you have to be so happy for him. He finally gets that Stanley Cup, in addition to players like Alex Ovechkin and Nicholas Backstrom, who obviously were winning their first Stanley Cup. But the entire team, with the exception of Brooks Orpik, was winning their first Stanley Cup. He was the only player on the team who had a Stanley Cup ring entering the playoffs. So
yeah, but back with Pittsburgh, he won.
A very impressive Stanley Cup playoffs for the Capitals, and they deserved it. They were the better team in the final.
I agree wholeheartedly, Dave. And what jumps out to me is, you know, Vegas was a great story all season long, but they were so reliant on goaltending, particularly in the playoffs, that when Marc-Andre Fleury, I think to some extent he's certainly tired in this series, but Marc-Andre Fleury was, I mean, he wasn't even average. He was below average in the finals. And as a result, they couldn't do anything to counter against that, the goaltending not being as elite as it was through the first three rounds.
Well, I would also argue that Washington played extremely well.
Absolutely.
I think Marc-Andre Fleury came back down to earth more than what, you know, he was in the first three rounds, for sure.
853 save percentage, 4.09 goals against average in the Stanley Cup Finals.
Yeah, of course. But I think it was the totality of the team effort. And mm-hmm. You can definitely point to the goaltending not being as good. But I think we saw a reverse of what folks here in Winnipeg saw with the Jets and Vegas series, and really Washington just played as a collective group better than Vegas did. And I thought that their attack off the rush, like, they did everything that Vegas was good at doing, and they just did it better, and they took it to the next level. And I thought that Alexander Ovechkin continued throughout the playoffs to elevate his game, and you could just see how just into it he was. And it was just, you could almost sense the desire, the real drive, like through the television set for him, and obviously for the entire team. But you could just see, I mean, he's a driver. He's the captain of that team. And you could just see, I mean, when he accepted the Conn Smythe from Gary Bettman, you could see how he pointed to the team. And like, this guy's a leader. I mean, there's no question about it. He's just such a good leader. And, you know, I mean, there's people who have maligned him for years about the various things, but you could just see how much he means to this team, how much winning meant to him, but also how much the team means to him. And you could see, I mean, that he doesn't have to make that gesture. The Conn Smythe is the MVP of the playoffs, the best player of the playoffs. And he didn't have to point to his teammates and say, you know, it's all because of you guys, but that's what he did. And I thought that was a very honest statement from Alexander Ovechkin, calling out his teammates. Cause as he talked about previously, all these guys stepped up. You got guys like Lars Eller, Devontae Smith-Pelly. All these guys played so well. And so it wasn't just one individual player taking the reins and doing everything. It was a collective team effort.
And Dave, Ovechkin would have been fine if Kuznetsov won the Conn Smythe.
Right. Yeah.
But I thought it was fitting that Ovechkin won the Conn Smythe, because you look at that final game, he scores a huge goal there. It was Washington's second goal.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't it the second goal?
It was the second goal for Washington.
The
2-1 goal.
No, he leads all players with 15 goals.
Yeah.
Amazing that Scheifele is still second.
Yeah.
Kuznetsov obviously had more points, but how many times in these playoffs did Ovechkin have a big goal, whether that was at even strength or on the power play? I mean, as Dave said, he's the leader of this team. He was excellent in every round. And I thought maybe his best hockey was that third round against Tampa Bay. I thought he was really good. And, you know, against Pittsburgh, he's also good in the first round against Columbus. But, you know, to Dave's point, you think about how they got to this point, how they won the Stanley Cup final. They were trailing in every series, and they won every series on the road. Really impressive.
They were down 2-0 in the first round. You thought that's going to be another, you know, another division win and then another meek exit for the Washington Capitals. They come back against Pittsburgh. They were down. Remember that game one against Pittsburgh. They were up 2-0 late in the third period, and Pittsburgh scores three goals in the third period to win in Washington. You think, here we go again. You're down to the Tampa Bay Lightning. I mean, it's cliche, but it's almost like they refused to be denied in the court in how they performed, especially against adversity. That's what was so impressive. Is
down 3-2 to Tampa.
Down 3-2 to Tampa. They came back. You know, down to Pittsburgh, they came back. Down to Columbus, they came back. Being down 1-0 to Vegas and then absolutely steamrolling them.
And the Capitals were not good in game one. I mean, that was
not
a good
game.
It was an ugly game.
Yeah.
I mean, and after that, I thought that they were clearly the better team. And we talked about it. I mean, three of the four wins were close. Mm-hmm. Game four, obviously, Washington smoked them. But for me, it was over after that game. I mean, you go up 3-1, and I realize you're going back to Vegas, and you're playing in front of your home fans. But we know the stats, guys. Only one team in NHL history has come back from 3-1. So the Capitals, as you said, Drew, they weren't going to be denied this year.
Six of the top 13 goal scorers, pardon me, point scorers in the playoffs are members of the Washington Capitals. And sure, they play more games than every other team, or with the exception of Vegas. But that was to your point, Ezzy, about the depth that the Capitals were able to display in these playoffs. Guys like Kuznetsov and Backstrom had better finals. Guys like Lars Eller stepping up. I mean, Lars Eller was a guy who, you know, a bit of a journeyman. When he signed that contract extension in Washington, you thought, it seems like a little bit of too much money. This is a guy who was able to play whatever role the Capitals needed him to play, and he played it well throughout the playoffs.
Well, Drew, we talked about it on last week's show. In last year's playoffs, Lars Eller, in 13 games, had no goals.
Yeah, disappeared.
Right? This year, he has 7 goals in 24 games. The other guy I didn't mention on that third line, Brett Connolly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Brett Connolly's a guy, it didn't work out for him in Tampa Bay. Then he went to Boston.
Yeah.
Then he signs with Washington. He has an assist on the Stanley Cup clinching goal by Lars Eller. This is a guy who was a 6th overall pick back in 2010. I mean, he's on your third line. Brett Connolly's a great player. People think of Brett Connolly, they maybe think, okay, he's a bottom six guy. He's not that good. Brett Connolly's a really good hockey player, and he was contributing on that third line. That third line, I thought, was maybe the best line for the Capitals in that series against Vegas.
Well, the Devontae Smith-Pelly story, this is a guy who, again, another guy who bounced around. He's been with the New Jersey Devils. He's been with the Montreal Canadiens. He's been all over the league. He signs a one-year contract where he's basically in a battle in training camp, scores 7 goals in the entirety of the regular season, and then in the playoffs is absolutely unconscious. It's funny how the playoffs always create these mythical stories of guys who are NHLers, but are middling NHLers.
You can go all the way back to John Drews.
Well, sure, that's
you
the
can
name
go to,
that always comes to mind.
Fernando Pisani.
In Edmonton, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, guys that always sort of step it up when it matters most. And Devontae Smith-Pelly is another guy who gets his name in the lore of playoff performers with what he did with the Washington Capitals this year in the playoffs.
Yeah, Devontae Smith-Pelly was a great story, and up and down the roster, guys, you know, we've talked about a lot of the players, and, you know, Brooks Orpik, I thought, was really impressive in the Stanley Cup final, kind of providing that, you know, steadying veteran presence, mm-hmm. even though, you know, Brooks Orpik's a guy that's been criticized, you know, being a guy in his mid-30s, you know, a little bit slower, but I thought he was excellent. I thought Matt Niskanen had a very underrated playoffs. Matt Niskanen's not a guy that gets a lot of headlines because the two best defensemen on the Capitals are John Carlson and Dmitry Orlov, so up and down that roster, they got contributions, but that's the way it is on a Stanley Cup winning team. You can't really have any passengers.
And the amazing thing is we've gone almost the first full segment without even mentioning Braden Holtby.
It's true.
I mean, the guy doesn't start the first two games, and then he goes unconscious.
Yeah, and just solid goaltending. I mean, he wasn't flashy. His numbers weren't incredible in the final, but he provided solid goaltending.
And he made the saves that he needed to make.
When we come back, Washington Capitals radio host Ben Raby is going to join us, talk more about the Capitals finally winning the Stanley Cup. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Saturday morning, you're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We are live on TSN 1290. Drew Mandel, Dave Minuk, Ezra Ginsberg with you in studio. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. You can reach us in studio via text message. Send your text to 129090. Standard messaging rates do apply. And our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets news and audio is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
He's the Washington Capitals radio host. He's a good friend of the program. His name is Ben Raby. Ben, good morning, and thanks very much for joining us.
good to be here on this this weekend without having to worry about another game on the itinerary. Good to be with you, fellas.
Well, that's why, you know, Ben, when we booked to have you on, the question was it going to end on Thursday night, or are we going to be previewing a game six on, I guess, would have been played tomorrow evening? Obviously, you're now preparing for a parade Tuesday night in Washington. You know, take us back to Thursday night in Vegas. The scene, the celebration on the ice, and then the aftermath in a city that's known for partying, saw an exceptional party featuring Lord Stanley's Cup.
Yeah, I think organizationally and for the core of the team, and of course that starts with Alex Ovechkin, I'm sure it came across even on the TV broadcast, the almost sigh of relief that they had when they were able to lift that Stanley Cup after the win. This was a long time coming, as you know, for the organization as a whole, which has waited 43 years for their first ever Stanley Cup title, for Alex Ovechkin specifically, 13 years into his career. And then you go down the line, Nick Backstrom, 11 seasons, 10 playoff appearances with the Capitals. John Carlson, Jay Beagle, Braden Holtby have been in the organization for a decade plus, each of those three. And as you know, with all the playoff shortcomings that they've had over the past few seasons, this was years in the making, as Braden Holtby suggested. Maybe the foundation had been laid over the years. But, you know, I said on our broadcast, fellas, the expression, right, you have to learn how to lose before you can win. This Capitals core, they had a master's, a PhD in playoff defeats. I mean, they had really waited a long time for this, as you know. And regarding the celebration, here's what I could tell you, fellas. I was fortunate enough to be part of an immediate reception at the team hotel following the win. This was about an hour and a half, 2.5 hours after the win. Team staff, family members were in on this. The real celebration, I'm almost certain, may have been a little bit past my bedtime. The players, you know, they enjoyed themselves from what I understand on this trip in Vegas. We were fortunate to be in on a low-key celebration, which kidding aside, was a great way for the players and team members to share the moment with family members. And then, of course, I think the videos and pictures are all over social media now. It looks like the boys had a good time on their own into the early hours in the morning.
So, Ben, how many bottles of champagne did the Capitals go through?
I'm sure a healthy amount of lemonades were consumed the other night. We'll put it that way.
Ben, you mentioned Braden Holtby there in your answer, and obviously we want to ask you about Alex Ovechkin, 2018 Conn Smythe Trophy winner, but do you think Holtby was given enough credit for how good he played in the Stanley Cup Final, especially games 2, 3, and 4?
Yeah, I think maybe internally and certainly within the team and those around the organization, I think have an appreciation. I don't think he needed a trophy necessarily to solidify that case that you're making. You know, really going back to the first round since he took over for Philip Grubauer, which it's easy to forget now, all those months ago, 2 months ago, that Grubauer was the starter for the postseason. But I really hope he showed, you know, he was able to put that rough end to the regular season that he had behind him, and this was very much this was vintage Holtby, if you will. This was you know, the 2016 Vezina Trophy winner, the candidate of a year ago for the Vezina Trophy. This was Holtby. This was some of Holtby at his best, and I think that game two save on Alex Tuck in the final minute, the regulation. I mean, we said on our broadcast that save he had on Alex Tuck with the paddle there, that would have been a terrific save on a Tuesday night against the Carolina Hurricanes in a 5-1 blowout. The fact that it happened in Game 2 in the Stanley Cup Final, in a one-goal game, keep in mind, with less than 2 minutes remaining in regulation, just an iconic moment, and one that, now that they did finish the job and win the Stanley Cup, one that I think will go down as perhaps the most important, the biggest save in franchise history.
You know, Ben, in order to win the Stanley Cup, you need contributions from the entire team. What player jumps out at you now that you've had a little bit of time to reflect on the playoffs, who had the biggest impact that you didn't expect maybe at the beginning of the playoffs?
I'll tell you three, and I'll try to do it quickly here. I mean, they both scored in game five the other night. Devontae Smith-Pelly had a terrific postseason, 7 goals in the playoffs after scoring 7 times during the regular season, right? If you're going to make a deep postseason run, you're always going to need somebody, at least one guy, maybe outperform his regular season output. Devontae Smith-Pelly certainly qualifies. Lars Eller ends up with the game-winning goal the other night in game five. He also, it should be noted, had the game winner that almost, you could say, started this championship run. Lars Eller, in the first round, Capitals trailed Columbus 2-0. They were on the road in Game 3 at Nationwide Arena in double overtime. So they faced a potential 3-0 deficit in round one. Lars Eller scores the eventual winner in double overtime, gets the Capitals steered in the right direction. And Eller, in the postseason, when they were without Backstrom, when they were missing Kuznetsov briefly in Game 2 of the Stanley Cup Final, Eller showed he can take his game to another level. And the third guy I want to highlight, fellas, because he doesn't necessarily come up on the score sheet, is Brooks Orpik, who I thought had a terrific postseason. As the Capitals went deeper into the run, I thought he just elevated his game. And a guy in Brooks Orpik who, you know, when the Capitals signed into a five-year, $27.5 million deal in 2014, a lot of people were shaking their heads wondering what he'd have left at the end of this contract. Well, at 37 years of age, he was very solid in his role as that rugged, stay-at-home, physical defenseman. I thought he had a terrific postseason. And again, as a 37-year-old, noteworthy that he got better, I felt, as the playoff run went along.
Ben Raby is our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Ben is the Washington Capitals radio host. We're discussing, of course, the Capitals Stanley Cup victory earlier this week in Vegas in Game 5. Ben, you know, you look back at some of the Washington Capitals teams over the last decade, over the last half decade, that didn't quite get this far, that didn't hoist the cup. And this team arguably isn't as talented as some of the other teams. So why was this team able to put it all together? Why was this team able to do what all the other Capitals teams haven't been able to do over the last decade?
Yeah, I think a few contributing factors. Number one, again, for all the talk that Alex Ovechkin got over the years, for all the blame, I should say, for the Capitals' postseason shortcomings, gets lost in the shuffle. Alex Ovechkin, even coming into this year, had a very good personal track record in the playoffs. He has traditionally elevated his game come the Stanley Cup playoffs. Capitals didn't always get the contribution lower down the depth chart, the secondary scores, if you will, and you asked a moment ago for some examples. You know, Devontae Smith-Pelly in his first year in Washington just took it to another level. They have not always had that in years past when they've made, you know, second-round exits. Some of those secondary contributions that may be received to an extent during the regular season, they would dry up come postseason time. That certainly wasn't the case this year. Another thing worth noting, they had quite a few fresh faces, I guess, this year. Smith-Pelly is one. A couple of rookies, Jacob Varana, scored the other night in the Stanley Cup Final. Chandler Stephenson from the Western Hockey League was in his first full NHL campaign. These were guys who played full-time in the playoffs. Christian Juice, a rookie on the blue line. They had three rookies throughout this entire run. And there was a thought that, and I buy this to an extent, you know, I heard this from various veterans, DJ Oshie, Brooks Orpik referenced this throughout the postseason run. There were guys on the team who just didn't know. They didn't know any better. They didn't know about the postseason disappointment. I mean, they'd heard them, but they had never experienced them. And going to face the Pittsburgh Penguins didn't bother them. And then there was sort of a youthful exuberance, maybe a naivete, that rubbed off to an extent on some of the veteran players, and they enjoyed it. They enjoyed having those fresh faces, and whether it was fresh faces in terms of rookies or fresh faces in terms of offseason acquisitions like a Devontae Smith-Pelly, like an Alex Chiasson, who was a fixture in the lineup the first three rounds of the playoffs. There were a few key cogs a little bit lower down the depth chart who had never been through this before, who to them, you know, that sort of, I guess you could say almost ignorance to it, rubbed off a little bit on some of those who had been through it so many times before.
Ben, to go back to Thursday night, you've covered the Capitals for a long time. What was it like for you and John Walton and the entire broadcast team to watch Alexander Ovechkin hand off the cup to coach Barry Trotz? Because Barry Trotz has waited a really long time, even longer than Ovechkin, to hoist that Stanley Cup.
Yeah, 19 years, you're absolutely right. And again, a lot of fellas on that Capitals team have waited a long time. I mean, without going into even too much detail here, you've got team president Dick Patrick, who is the 35th consecutive year with the Capitals, who joined the organization in 1982. There were a lot of people from top upper management right on down to the players and even equipment managers, that type of staff. A lot of folks were waiting a long time. And regarding, you know, the experience for myself, my ninth year covering the team, and John Walton, who's been in the organization a decade plus, dating back to his days with the Hershey Bears, this was a really neat run to experience, I guess you could say, because having covered three of the President's Trophy winning teams myself over the past 9 years plus, this was kind of an unexpected run, I'll be honest. For all the years that they were favored to win, even though they won the Metropolitan Division this year and they were a division champion, I think realistically when the postseason began, I don't think many of us were expecting to be talking here on June 8th about a Stanley Cup champion. And the way it unfolded and the way they were able to rally in all four series, it should be noted, just the second team in NHL history to do that. It was just it was a neat run. It was almost, like I said, unexpected to an extent that they were able to pull it off, and it just made it, you know, all the more special to witness and to see some of those fellas you mentioned have to wait so long and for it to come under these circumstances. If you had said 8 years ago that the Perse Capital title would be with a 2017-18 team that was not expected to necessarily make a deep run, I think many of us would have been surprised, but here we are, and like I said, it maybe made the run even all the more special.
Well, Ben, you're talking about long waiting, and there's a Capitals fan base that's been waiting, for, like you said, 43 years for this. What's the reaction like right now in Washington?
It's been phenomenal, and from what I understand, you know, we obviously weren't here on Thursday night, but from what I understand, folks, with the exception of some litter and trash around the city, that, you know, folks handled it in good taste, which as you guys know, isn't necessarily always the case in various cities, but this city has embraced this, and, you know, fans have waited a long time. Not only Washington Capitals fans, fellas, but this is D.C.'s first pro championship in any of the four major sports since 1992. You know, Redskins, Washington Bullets, / Wizards, the Washington Nationals. This is a long time coming for a sports fan base. So I would tell you, the Capitals, I'm almost certain, adopted a lot of fans, and I'm not joking about this. They adopted a lot of fans on this run, casual sports fans in this market. You know, at the end of the day, it really is a largely Redskins town in Washington. But the Capitals got a lot of folks, whether they're bandwagon jumpers or just longtime suffering sports fans in these parts. A lot of folks have jumped on board. You saw the videos the other day at the Hockey Night in Canada broadcast at it. The streets here in D.C. the other night were just filled ridiculous amounts. And real quick, I'll tell you this. They sold out Capital One Arena the other night for a viewing party, right, just to watch the game on the Jumbotron, whereas 20 years ago, the last time they made the Stanley Cup Final, they were swept in four games by the Detroit Red Wings. No joke, they struggled to sell tickets to the extent that they had to recruit Detroit tour buses to bring people in to help fill what was then called MCI Center. So, you know, you can sort of see the big difference 20 years makes, but this fan base, this city has rallied behind them tremendously and should be an awesome atmosphere Tuesday at the parade.
Last question for you, Ben, and we always appreciate your time and your insight. The business of sport doesn't take long before it rears its ugly head yet again. John Carlson, of course, an unrestricted free agent. We know that Barry Trotz is an unrestricted free agent, for lack of a better term. How do you see those two situations playing out over the next weeks, you know, even month or so?
Boy, it'll be interesting. I'll tell you this, as far as Barry Trotz is concerned, I don't think he has to worry too much about finding work, whether it's back here in Washington or elsewhere. I mean, Stanley Cup champion, winning coaches, fifth all-time wins in NHL history. I think he'll be okay, and he'll get paid some way or another. But certainly the job he did this year under very unorthodox circumstances, very admirable, and I'll say in his 4 years in Washington, arguably the best coaching job he's done. He won the Jack Adams 2 years ago, but I'll say this was even before the playoffs, just to get them to the division title. Thought it was some of his best work. Again, given what was lost in the offseason, given the unorthodox setup he was facing, thought he handled it tremendously, tremendously well. And regarding John Carlson, you know, from what I understand, all parties want to make it work that he stays here long term. He has a foundation here. His wife is from the Washington, D.C. area. That being said, General Manager Brian McClellan, I'll have to get creative to open up some salary cap space. Perhaps not unlike what we saw a year ago, where in order to retain free agent T.J. Oshie, Capitals had to trade Marcus Johansson, an existing part on the roster. If you're going to bring John Carlson back, you're going to have to free up salary cap somewhere. I would anticipate if Carlson is back, which is a big if, but if that happens, I would anticipate an active player from the roster being unloaded in a different capacity.
Ben Raby is the Washington Capitals radio host. Ben, appreciate your insight. We'll let you get back to Baby Raby in the background there.
Yeah, there you go. And just spend some family time now. Yes, the Raby baby is a good boy. Thank you, fellas.
Take care, Ben. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
When we come back, we shift our focus to the Winnipeg Jets. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
On TSN1290.ca.
Getting set for the faceoff. Little wins it. Morrissey scores! Clean faceoff win by Brian Little. And Josh Morrissey has his first NHL playoff goal. And it's a big one. This game is tied at one.
That was from the Western Conference Finals between the Jets and the Golden Knights. Game 5. Josh Morrissey off the draw. blasted one past Marc-Andre Fleury to tie the game. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Saturday morning here on TSN 1290. This segment brought to you by Dr. Les Rikus and the team at Linden Market Dental Center, official dentist of Illegal Curve Hockey. Don't be an Ezzy. Always wear a mouth guard and give yourself peace of mind protection, as well as facial, teeth, and mouth protection. To make an appointment to get your teeth to ting, visit LindenMarketDentalCenter.com. Josh Morrissey, one of the Jets' offseason priorities, undoubtedly. He's a restricted free agent that the Jets will want to get under contract, given that he's solidified himself as the Jets' top-pairing left-side defenseman. He is an RFA, as I mentioned. He has no arbitration eligibility, though, so he is in a slightly different position than a lot of the other RFAs that we've talked about over the last few weeks here on the show and here on the station. So a lot of people are saying that they expect Josh Morrissey to get a bridge deal, that maybe he gets a 1 or a 2 year deal because he really doesn't have any, he doesn't have a lot of options, he doesn't have a lot of leverage against the Jets. I'm a little surprised though. Wouldn't you, if you're Kevin Cheveldayoff though, why are you interested in a bridge deal for Josh Morrissey as opposed to getting him under contract for maybe for the next 4 years or 5 years, whatever number you want to pick, at a more reasonable price than if you waited 2 years and he exceeded that bridge deal and then you had to sign him to another long-term deal at that point?
I think if you're Kevin Cheveldayoff, guys, the reason why you want to sign him to a bridge deal is pretty obvious, because his average annual value would be lower.
But can't you do that? Can't you keep that AAV lower on a 4 or 5 year deal as well and maybe save yourself some money down the road? Maybe it costs you a little bit more now, but you save some money down the road. I mean, aren't you taking a bit of a risk in only signing them to a bridge deal right now?
I think the AAV would definitely be higher if it's a longer term deal, but I don't think it would be significantly higher. Like, I don't think you're talking about a $7 million a year defenseman right
no,
now.
Certainly not.
So I think if you're signing him to a 2 year deal, you're probably going to be around $3 to $4 million maybe for Josh Morrissey. And Josh Morrissey is a different case than Jacob Trouba. And it's not because there was the whole issue with usage. It's because Josh Morrissey didn't come into the NHL as early as Jacob Trouba. Mm-hmm. Remember, Trouba played 1 year with the University of Michigan, but Josh Morrissey spent an entire year in the American Hockey League. So it's not apples and apples.
After finishing his junior hockey eligibility.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Josh Morrissey came into the NHL a year later than Jacob Trouba.
Mm-hmm.
So really, he's only played two full NHL years, as opposed to when Trouba signed his bridge deal. He had played three full NHL years. So I just thought that was worth pointing out, Drew. But I don't think that there's any doubt that Josh Morrissey factors in long-term with the Jets.
Certainly.
I mean, I've said it. Dave said it. A lot of people on the station have said it. I mean, I think Josh Morrissey is the Jets' best defenseman right now. He's only 23 years old. I strongly believe that. I mean, Jacob Trouba, I think, is the Jets' second-best defenseman. That's your top pair. And they were excellent this year. One of the main reasons why the Jets' goals against, Drew, was down so much from a couple of years back. So I think there's no doubt that the Jets are considering signing Josh Morrissey to a long-term deal, whether that's this summer or 2 summers from now. I think we'd all agree with that. So I think if you're signing him to a bridge deal, it's to save a little bit of money on your salary cap. That's why you're doing
it.
In the short term.
With the risk, of course, that it's going to cost you more money
for two years
down the road.
Right, and the risk, I think, you know, for the Jets is the reward for Josh Morrissey, right? Josh Morrissey, you know, he puts up a couple of 30 or 35 point seasons. He's healthy. Yeah, he's going to be probably a $5 to $6 million a year defenseman, maybe a little bit higher, Drew. But I think when you're talking about some of the other players that the Jets have to sign to long-term contracts, Connor Hellebuck, Jacob Trouba, Patrick Laine, they might sign to a 7 or 8 year extension. You're going to have
Blake
to sign
Wheeler.
Blake Wheeler eventually. So I think for the Jets, a bridge contract is absolutely a possibility here. There's also the possibility that the Jets decide they want to sign him to a 6, 7, 8 year deal. I don't think they're going to sign him to anything less than that when they decide to sign him long term. It just doesn't make any sense to sign him to like a 4 or 5 year deal. They want to eat up as many UFA years as they can, right?
Well, if you sign him to, sorry, Dave, I want you to get in here first.
No. I simply was going to add to what Ez was saying is that I think you're just having to factor in what you want to do because Josh Morrissey, as Ez just touched on, is part of the plan. And regardless of whether his contract this time is a short term contract you know, or a long-term one, which I'm more inclined to believe it'll be short-term. I think it's also because you're trying to factor in all the other intangibles within this group as to what you can do for the next couple of years, because you know you're going to get Josh Morrissey, and maybe when you're signing him to that longer-term deal, some of those other players may be coming off the books.
Like so, Dmitry Kulikov, right. Like Tyler Myers.
Exactly. Yeah. So that would be my rationale, is that some of the bigger contracts that you still have mm-hmm. won't be on the books. So when you give that next big deal to Josh Morrissey, he becomes one of those big contracts instead of a Tyler Myers or a Dmitry Kulikov. So this way, you A, are replacing, you know, an A with B, you know, Myers with Morrissey or something like that. And you also allow yourself a little bit of leverage in terms of maybe trying to get Paul Stastny under the books, or maybe trying to do a few other things. So I just don't think it's as big a concern with the team, because I think, look, regardless of whether it's a 2-year deal or it's a 6-year deal, it's going to either happen now or it's going to happen in 2. You know what I mean? Like, he is part of their plan going forward.
Josh Morrissey knows that. He knows that if he signs a bridge deal, his next contract's going to be 7 or 8 years.
Because he's a key member, right. Barring something tremendously unforeseen, he's a right. key member of this team and of this franchise going forward. And, you know, if you had to pick a spot on the team that is probably weakest, it's probably left side defense.
Right.
Behind him, there's Dmitry Kulikov, there's Ben Chiarot, there's Joe Morrow. But Morrissey's heads and shoulders above those guys
yes.
when it comes to your left side defense.
He's your top pairing defenseman for the next 10 to 15 years.
Sure. According to the model, it's Matt Cain is this guy who creates a model where he yep. estimates future contracts. Mm-hmm.
And he does a great
contract
job.
Extension. He does a really good job, and he does yep. a comprehensive one for almost the entire league. He says on a 1-year deal, Morrissey would get around $2.7 million, all the way up. If they went on a 5-year deal, it'd be looking at $4.1 million AAV over the next 5 years. Let's start.
So you're probably saving, Drew, around $500,000 to $1 million by signing him to a bridge deal versus a 6 or 7 or 8 year deal, I'd say.
Would you have a problem with Morrissey at $2.7 million?
He's going to make more than that.
Yeah, I think that's low.
Well, they're not going to sign him to a 1-year deal, right? It's going to be a 2-year bridge.
Well, I mean, it doesn't have to be. It could be a 1-year bridge. Because then
you don't see 1-year bridge deals very often.
Not very often, but it's certainly an option. I mean,
sure.
For the Winnipeg Jets.
I think he'll probably.
I believe that's
be...
what they did with Connor Hellebuyck last year, if I'm not mistaken.
They did.
He signed a 1-year deal.
Yeah, they gave him a 1-year deal.
Yeah. So I mean, it's not.
That was a little bit different though, because he spent more time in college.
Well, and Hellebuyck,
and he was,
I think,
older.
Was on a prove it contract, whereas Morrissey has proven
yes.
it with his performance.
Yep.
Not so much on the offensive side, because the offensive side of his game hasn't, I mean, it's there, but it hasn't really flourished.
Well, he's not really given those same opportunities.
That's my point, is that he's not.
He doesn't play power play. I mean, no. I don't think Josh Morrissey's ever going to be a 70-point defenseman.
No.
I think he can be a 50-point defenseman, though.
You know, if the opportunities develop. I mean, the Jets, of course, you go with the 4 forwards, 1 defenseman on their power play, and that defenseman is usually Dustin Byfuglien
or
Jacob Trouba. So Morrissey doesn't have the power play opportunities because he's a shutdown defenseman for the Jets. I mean, that's what his role primarily is.
I'd like to
is.
See him on the power play, quite frankly.
Well, I mean, they'd have to sort of rejig their entire format.
He's got an underrated shot, actually.
I think the reality is you're not paying Josh Morrissey based on his points. You're paying him based on what he does for you defensively.
Right, the role he plays in your own zone.
That's right.
It'll be interesting to see. That's one of a litany of contracts the Jets and Kevin Cheveldayoff have to figure out and work with in this offseason. When we come back, the NHL's focus now shifts to the NHL draft. It's a couple weeks away. We're going to talk about what the Jets are going to do at the draft. What you expect from the Jets, given that they don't have a first-round pick for the first time in franchise history. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We are live on TSN Radio. 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
With our first selection, the Winnipeg Jets are proud to select Christian Vasilainen, Frölunda, Swedish Elite League.
That was from the first round of the 2017 NHL draft. You won't be hearing that this year. The Jets, of course, don't have a first round selection, traded to the St. Louis Blues.
Their first pick is 60th overall.
Yeah. It's going to be a while.
It's not a
60th.
It's not a position we're used to seeing at the Winnipeg Jets drafting.
It's certainly not, but this allows me to promote, of course, that draft coverage will be here on TSN 1290. It'll be 2 weeks from yesterday is the first round. So the first round is in 13 days. And then rounds 2 through 7, including the Jets' first-round pick, will be live on Saturday.
First pick. First round pick.
Pardon me. First pick. Yes. Thank you, Dave. Will be Saturday, June the 23rd. We'll be with you on that Saturday starting at 10 a.m. all the way through the conclusion of the NHL draft. So you can hear it live here on TSN 1290. All the draft coverage as you've come to expect from your home of the Winnipeg Jets, TSN 1290.
I'm pumped for our draft show. This is the first time since 2012 that a legal curve has not been traveling to the draft.
Yeah.
We've been at every draft from 2013 up until this year.
It's true. We weren't able to make it this year with some extenuating family circumstances. And, of course, the Jets not having a first-round pick is a happy coincidence, I would say. The draft next year in Vancouver, a lot easier to get to Vancouver than it is necessarily.
Yeah, we'll be in Van City.
Get to Dallas, Texas. Anyways, this segment of the show brought to you by our good friends Frank and Mauro Zappia of Zappia Group Realty, official realtors of Illegal Curve Hockey. When 95% of your clients coming via a referral, it shows your commitment to honesty, integrity, and a total dedication to client satisfaction. For all your real estate needs, come shake hands with Frank and Mauro Zappia online at zappiagroup.com.
As always, shout out to Frank Zappia. He correctly predicted that the Caps would defeat the Vegas Golden Knights when many people were taking the Golden Knights.
Well, there you go. Shout out to Frank for his prognostication skills. Speaking of prognostication skills, what are you expecting from the Winnipeg Jets at the upcoming NHL draft? Obviously, as
I said... They're not making a pick in the first round.
Well, are they? I mean, could you foresee a situation in which the Jets, you know, traditionally not the most active team when it comes to the trade market? Could you see a scenario in which the Jets all of a sudden get back into the first round? Maybe negotiations aren't going well with one of their pending free agents, or that they have to make some salary cap maneuvering to get everybody they want under contract, and all of a sudden the Jets might be active in Dallas on the trade floor. We know that usually there's certainly rumors that happen at Dallas, and it's a bit of a silly season where a lot of things are talked about that don't come to fruition necessarily. But could you see a scenario that gets the Jets back to being a player, an active player at this upcoming NHL draft?
I do see a scenario where the Jets move up in the draft. I don't think the Jets are going to move up into the top three or the top five or probably even the top 15 or 20, but I could see Chevy swinging a move to get a late first-round pick or maybe an early second-round pick. You look at a team like the Montreal Canadiens, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Canadiens have the third overall pick, and then they've got two picks early in that second round. We talked about it, the Jets don't pick till 60th overall. So I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, Chevy has, a rabbit up his sleeve and he makes a move and, you know, he maybe acquires a second round pick or, as I said, a late first rounder. We just don't see those high picks traded very often. I know there's a lot of chatter, you know, about certain teams moving down. You know, the Ottawa Senators have the fourth overall pick. There's been some chatter that, you know, maybe they try to shop that pick to get a player coming back the other way, and that obviously might depend on whether Erik Karlsson is traded, right? But you just oftentimes don't see those high-end picks traded. You think back to 2013, Drew, when the New Jersey Devils pulled off that trade with the Vancouver Canucks. They got Corey Schneider, and then Vancouver got the sixth overall pick.
Mm-hmm.
You just don't see those types of trades very
often.
That
was the Vertanen selection of
Horvat.
That was Horvat, pardon
yeah,
me.
Yeah, it was
right.
Bo Horvat, yeah. Sixth overall. I don't think the Jets are going to get a top 10 or top 15 pick, but considering how well they've drafted in the later stages of the draft, right, Dave? I mean, we've talked about it a lot. 2015, Sammy Niku. I mean, Connor Hellebuck is a fifth-round pick from back in 2013. So I'm not worried at all that the Jets aren't going to draft some good players, you know, in the second, third round. They don't have a fourth round pick because they traded that for Joe Morrow. But when you think about, you know, some of the players that could possibly be on the move, and again, I'm not saying Tyler Myers is a guy that's for sure going to be traded, but he is in the last year of his contract. And you do have Tucker Poolman, who I believe is ready to be your third pairing right side defenseman. Do you maybe try to move a Tyler Myers to get a draft pick? I don't think you get a first round pick for Tyler Myers, but maybe you get a second rounder?
Well, Dave, do you expect the situation to sort of play out where Kevin Cheveldayoff, obviously they'll know the players that they are more likely to be able to select over in the second round. They're not, like, to Ezzy's point, they're not going to move up into a top 10 draft selection. Is this the kind of thing where you could see the Jets targeting a certain player, and if he's there in the second round that maybe they trade up to get him. They've only traded up into the first round once before, and that was to acquire Logan Stanley, if you remember. They traded up to get him, and he's still obviously going to play with the Manitoba Moose this upcoming season after finishing his junior career. Is this going to be a wait-and-see approach for Kevin Cheveldayoff to see if a guy maybe slips on the draft board, a guy that they think would fit with the team, and then they try and move up from really 60th overall to try and get him in the second round?
Well, Drew, you're always having conversations, and, you know.
We're talking, and having phone calls.
And calls come in, and calls go out. And
yes, that's how a phone works. Thank you.
To answer your question, of course, that is a possibility. I mean, whether it plays out that way, I have no idea. I mean, I suspect every team goes in with a certain list of guys that, you know, their scouts and their scouting staff have spent a lot of time throughout the season looking at and becoming favorites. And, you know, that's why they have the pro scout meetings ahead of the draft. So all the pro scouts can, you know, really discuss the players and really kind of create their own internal rankings within the Jets framework mm-hmm. of who they like and who they want to see drafted and become a member of the Winnipeg Jets. So I suspect over the course of the next couple of weeks, you're going to see that with the pro scout meetings ahead of the draft in Dallas, and you'll simply see, like, these guys, just like I said, they put so much work throughout the year into scouting out all these young players that, you know, again, like I said, you have an idea as to who you like, but of course there's going to be a number of other scouts who have players that they've ranked highly. So again, you put it all together, you see where it comes, and if that player is still available, you know, maybe you think he slipped 10 spots, well then yeah, maybe you swing a move to move up and grab him.
Guys, the reality is, unless the Jets are trading a Tyler Myers or a Brian Little or a player like a, you know, Joel Armia or Brandon Tanev, coupled with another draft pick, I mean, they're not getting into the first round.
No,
Not going to get a first round pick by trading a Marco Dano, for example.
No, of course not.
So, and those are the players that they're going to look to trade, because they're not trading any top six pieces. I mean, we don't even have to mention names. Shifley, Lion A, Ehlers, yeah, Wheeler, these guys, they're not getting traded. So you're talking about bottom six forwards. And same thing goes for Kyle Connor and Jack Roslovic. I mean, these guys just completed their first NHL seasons. They're not going anywhere. So as far as I'm concerned, unless you're moving a significant player like Brian Little or Tyler Myers, and again, I'm not suggesting that they trade those players because I think they're good players. But if you actually want to move up into the late first round or early second round, you're going to have to give up something significant. Just like the Jets acquired Paul Stastny and they gave up a late first round pick.
Sure. I mean, nothing comes for free. There's no question about that. I mean, you look at the entirety of the Jets draft situation. So they have a second round pick and they have a third round pick. They don't have a fourth round pick that was traded to Montreal for Joe Morrow, and that seems like a trade you would do.
And that was worth it.
Oh, absolutely.
Because I strongly believe the Jets will sign Joe Morrow to a contract.
He's an RFA, so there's no
reason. So it was worth giving up a fourth-round pick.
For a guy who, at the very least, adds to your depth on your left side, where, again, you don't have a ton of depth. There's no reason not to do that trade over and over again. They actually have two fifth-round picks, their own and one from the Boston Bruins that they acquired in exchange for Drew Stafford.
Right, so maybe you package one of your fifth-round picks with another player.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I'm not saying it's Marco Dano, but maybe it's a Marco Dano. Maybe it's another player.
Sure.
I mean, we don't want to speculate, but it's going to be one of those types of players, a fourth-line player or an extra forward. Then maybe you move up and you get a fourth-round pick, or maybe you couple something up and you get a middle second-round pick or a third-round pick, something like that.
You have a little bit of draft capital in those later rounds that could allow you to move up if you wanted to package things together. And then they have their own sixth- and seventh-round picks as well that they can use. You know, either, I mean, they've had some success later on in the draft. We know that. And you're really throwing a dart. A lot of times later on in the draft, you're throwing a dart and you're hoping that players develop. But, you know, Sammy Niku is a guy that they threw a dart at in his
seventh round.
Has certainly developed.
Yep.
Mason Appleton,
another guy. Connor Hellebuck, another guy they threw a dart at. I mean, you're talking about a tremendous amount of draft success, relatively speaking, later on in the draft that is you know, proving to be the foundation of your team alongside some of your former top picks that have begun to blossom.
That's becoming less of a dart throwing and becoming a little, the scouting staff here probably requires some reward for their gems that they're picking up out of the diamonds in the rough, if you will, late in the rounds.
Anytime you can hit on a draft pick in the fifth, sixth, seventh rounds, fourth round even, and that player turns into an NHL regular, that's how you fill out a, and assuming you're also hitting on your first round picks, that's how you fill out a Stanley Cup roster, by getting guys like that who you don't expect much from, and they blossom into NHL players. You just look up and down different lineups, and that's where those teams are getting their success from. The Jets have had that success. We'll see if they're able to replicate it again in Dallas in about 13, 14 days' time.
The Jets will be fine without a first-round pick. Absolutely. They've got all of their first-round picks in the lineup right now.
Logan Stanley will be with the Moose, and Veselainen will be with the Moose next year as well. So that's how you continue to build a decent roster. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Michael Trakos. He's the senior hockey writer for Post Media. We'll put a bow on the Stanley Cup playoffs. We'll put a bow on the entirety of the 2017-18 NHL season. Michael Trakos up next. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Hour number two of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show starts now on TSN 1290. Drew Mandel, Dave Minuk, Ezra Ginsberg with you in studio. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets news and audio is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
From the National Post, he's the senior hockey writer for Post Media. He's our very good friend, Michael Trakos. Michael, good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks, boys. Appreciate you having me on.
Of course.
Talking about this great final we've had here. Still can't get over the fact that it only went five games.
You thought it would be a longer, more competitive final? Is that what I can assume by those comments?
Well, I thought it was going to go seven. You know what? Just based on what Vegas was able to do against Winnipeg, I had my dad saying, oh, you'll be back in four. Vegas is just going to sweep them. And I was thinking, yeah, I don't know. I think Washington is a team of destiny this year. That being said, I'm like, you won't see me until after game seven. That's a guarantee. And I'm shocked that it went so few games and that Washington was able to figure out a team that no one else in the NHL really could figure out all year.
Well, Mike, what was the party like at Tiesto's house after?
Yeah, I didn't get invited. I don't know if you guys read the Washington Post story, the blow-by-blow. Just it was literally hour-by-hour, minute-by-minute, second-by-second, I guess beer-by-beer count. And, geez, I missed out on that party, boys. I know. I didn't do so. I didn't do poorly in Vegas, but I definitely didn't party with Tiesto and whoever else the Washington Capitals seem to be partying with, which was basically all of Vegas.
Mike, let's start right off with Alexander Ovechkin. When you heard that he was being awarded the Conn Smythe Trophy, was that the right selection?
Yeah, I was part of the voting committee. It was 18 of us, and 13 had Ovechkin first on our ballot, and five others had him second and Kuznetsov first. So I wasn't shocked. I had already written it in my story and was just basically waiting to hit send when Bettman announced it. And, you know, it was the obvious choice. A couple years ago, Sidney Crosby won the Conn Smythe, even though Phil Kessel had more points. And to everyone, Phil Kessel was probably their best offensive player. But when you're talking about who the MVP was, it was no doubt that it was Sidney Crosby. And this year was very similar, where Kuznetsov was arguably maybe the most talented player in the playoffs and the most offensive player in the playoffs for Washington. But when you're talking about that heart and soul guy, the player who, even when he wasn't factoring in the goals on the score sheet, was affecting the game in a positive way, to a man, you go around that Washington Capitals room and everyone would have said it was Ovechkin. So it was the right call, in my opinion.
Michael, we know they're going to be backing up, some NHL team is going to be backing up a Brinks truck of full of money to give to John Carlson in free agency. Which team do you think it'll be?
It's going to be Washington. There's no way they're going to let him go. Like, you know, a year ago at this time, I think Brian McClellan, the GM of the Capitals, was ready to, I guess, bid farewell to John Carlson. I think he was preparing for maybe a retool in Washington just based on how things were going. That's completely changed now. I think when you look at that roster, you can definitely see them contending at least for a second straight cup and being competitive for the next 5 years. All their pieces are in place, and it's going to take bringing back John Carlson to do that. And you know, the Capitals are going to have to get creative. He's looking at possibly $8 million a year for the next 8 years, and maybe you can get him at $7.5 per year, but still going to push Washington way past their cap limit. So does it mean that they have to trade a guy like Matt Niskanen? Does it mean they have to maybe buy out Brooks Orpik or trade an Andre Burakovsky? Someone's going to have to go, and that's the fact, the face of life when you do win a Stanley Cup is you're going to have to lose some players that you didn't want to lose, but you're not losing John Carlson. This guy is a stud. Led all defensemen in scoring in the playoffs as well as the regular season. Logged close to 27 minutes a game in both the playoffs and the regular season. He's an elite defenseman, and those guys don't come around very often. And when you look at Washington's defense, they don't have a whole lot of other pieces beyond Carlson. So they're going to have to figure out a way to get it done. Like I said, they might have to lose one or two bodies, but when you're talking about bringing him back, it's worth it.
Michael Tracos, our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, talking about the Stanley Cup playoff, Stanley Cup, talking about the Stanley Cup final. Michael, you mentioned they're going to bring back Carlson. Are they going to bring back their head coach, Barry Trotz, as well?
That's one that I could see maybe not happening. Something happened during Trotz's tenure there, going into the season in that lame duck scenario, and I think feelings were hurt beyond the point of repair. It's going to take, like you said, backing up a Brinks truck. It's going to take that and maybe a huge apology. Maybe someone's going to have to go down on knees and really kind of woo Barry back to Washington, because I think his mind is made up in the sense that he's out of there. And, you know, Long Island is, or Brooklyn, I should say, is an obviously easy kind of target with Lou Lamoriello looking for an experienced coach. Another one to keep an eye on is Minnesota, where Paul Fenton comes in. Mm-hmm. He obviously has a long history with Barry going back to Nashville, and maybe he decides to can boost Boudreau in order to make it happen. But for Barry to go back to Nashville, like I said, it's going to have to take some serious wooing from Brian McClellan and the rest of that staff.
You know, Mike, Vegas comes up short in the Stanley Cup final, but I think you'd agree. I mean, this season was a resounding success. They win the division. They go all the way to the Stanley Cup final. They defeat the Jets in five games in the Western Conference final. In your opinion, is this Vegas Golden Knights team going to be okay next year? Do you think they're going to be a playoff team next year? Because they have a lot of work to do when you consider that guys like James Neal, he's a UFA, William Karlsson, he's an RFA, David Perron is a UFA, Lucas Sabiza is a UFA. George McPhee has a lot of players to sign here.
Yeah, you know, I could come up with five reasons why Vegas could quite potentially be back in the Stanley Cup final and come up with maybe 5 to 10 reasons why they won't even make the playoffs. It could go either way. And you know what? I'm sort of leaning towards they might not make the playoffs next year. When you think about all the things that had to go right with the Golden Knights this year, I don't know if that's really realistic to ask guys like Carlson to score 40 goals again, for Marchessault and Riley Smith to play well above their kind of potential, for Marc-Andre Fleury to have just a ridiculous save percentage, not just in the playoffs, but throughout the regular season. So there was obviously magic going on this year in Vegas. And you know, a lot of times we see this, like with New Jersey. They make it to the Cup Final, and the next year they're not even in the playoffs. And it happens more than you I don't know, might think it should happen. So you mentioned the UFAs. The only thing that I could say is if Vegas is in the running for Erik Karlsson and they manage to land one of those big-time free agents, that could definitely sway this team into being a contender next year. But, yeah, I'm kind of skeptical that on paper this team is good enough to do it again.
Michael, how validating must this be for Braden Holtby, considering what happened during the regular season? Doesn't start the first two games of the Stanley Cup first round, and yet wins the Stanley Cup. Just what must he be going through after the entire 2017-18 season?
Yeah, well, it's validation. You know, a lot of people had written off Holtby at the end of this year, saying that he just wasn't good enough, and Philip Grubauer was maybe taking his spot, not just temporarily, but that was sort of happening, and that the contract that Washington signed him to was a mistake. So, you know, they don't get past Pittsburgh without Holtby. They don't even get past Columbus without Holtby. And, you know, he outplayed Andrei Vasilevskiy in the conference final, outplayed Marc-Andre Fleury in the final. And I think he's back to being in that upper echelon of goaltenders, along with the Carey Prices, who also took a step back this year, and guys like Pekka-Rinne, who, we saw what happened to him in the playoffs. So the goaltending position is very fickle. You can be on top of the world 1 year or even 1 month, and then the next one, you can look like your game is in complete disarray. So good on Braden Holtby for kind of getting it done. And, he's another guy, like, along with Backstrom, Kuznetsov, and Ovechkin, had past failures in the playoffs. It was really trying to work away or work through those demons. And, definitely did it. So good on him because, he's a really – you talk to him, and he's just a salt-of-the-earth guy. And he's one of the few goalies that talks on game day. So I think the media is always pulling for a guy like him.
Michael Tracos, our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Michael's, of course, with Post Media. He's the senior hockey writer. Michael, the Capitals have the most regular season points over the last 10 years, and the absence of the Stanley Cup was always what was hanging over them and sort of looming over their success over the past decade. Now that they have that Stanley Cup, do we change our perception of this Capitals team over the last decade?
I think so. I think it only takes one. And, San Jose is the same thing. They didn't even win a Stanley Cup, but the fact that they were able to reach the final a couple years ago and lose to Pittsburgh, I think that changed a lot of people's opinions on Joe Thornton and just that Caps team and the Caps team that Doug Wilson was able to put together. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter what you do in the regular season. You do need that playoff success. And sometimes you don't even need a Stanley Cup for it to happen. But, now that Alex Ovechkin has his cup and all those guys who've been there, maybe not 13 years, but for the better part of a decade, have gotten over that hump, I think it definitely puts them in a different light. And I think we look at them differently. There's that asterisk isn't there anymore. I think Greg Wyshynski from ESPN was saying, it's not Alex Ovechkin is great, but there's no but anymore. It's just, he's back to legendary status, and maybe he should never have been away from that legendary status, but definitely up there with the Crosbys again.
Mike, last question for you here. I know you got to go. You're in Toronto. We have to ask you, when does John Tavares sign that contract with the Leafs?
Oh, it's not happening. Now that Lou's in Long Island or Brooklyn, there's no way he lets him out of his grip. So that ship has sailed, boys. John Tavares isn't going to Toronto. He's not going anywhere except for the New York Islanders.
Really?
I'm positive on this. I definitely don't see that happening. I don't see Carlson going. I don't see John Tavares going. I think the next big free agent is probably going to be Paul Stastny. And I wonder if Winnipeg tries to move heaven and earth to try to bring him back as well.
Well, I'll tell you what, Michael, we like bold sauces on this program, and we like bold opinions, and that's a bold opinion. So we might have to circle back to that after July 1st, but I like that you came in strong with that one on John Tavares.
I think you might be right on that one.
And if I'm wrong, I'm not available after July 1st.
Yeah, we know. Yeah. You're on holidays at that point in time. I get it. Michael, thank you, buddy. Appreciate it. Appreciate your time all season long, and of course, we'll do it again throughout the summer.
All right, thanks, guys. Appreciate you having me on as well.
Take care. Michael Tracos, senior hockey writer for Post Media, one of our all-timers here on the program. When we come back, we're going to talk about the moves in Long Island. We know that Garth Snow is out. We know that Doug Waite is out. Lou Lamoriello's in. Who's their new head coach? We'll talk about that next, and what impact does that have on the John Tavares contract situation. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
On TSN1290.ca.
That one grabbed and pitched aside by Holtby. Carlson off Ward, kept alive. Letty a shot. Oh, directed on goal. Score! Tavares!
John Tavares scoring for the New York Islanders in the 2015 playoffs against the Capitals. We'll find out in just a matter of weeks now if he's going to have an opportunity again to score for the New York Islanders. You just heard Michael Tracos say that he thinks it's almost a done deal that Tavares stays on Long Island. It's a bold statement. Time will tell if he is right or if he is wrong. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We are live here on TSN 1290. This segment brought to you by our good friends at Keener Jerseys. Specializing in customization services and branded team apparel, Keener Jerseys is changing the game with world-class craftsmanship and unparalleled service.
If you want awesome jerseys for your rec team or have a jersey you want personalized, visit KeenerJerseys.com or check out their showroom at 982 Portage Avenue. That's the corner of Portage and Sherburn. Tell them that Illegal Curve sent you.
Might have to get a Devontae Smith Pelly jersey now that he popped in 7 goals.
Would you get a retro one or would you get a current one?
Like retro from his time with the Canadians or
No.
I'd probably go with the Devils.
No, like a retro, like Capitals jersey. One, I mean.
Like the old school Caps, 80s Rod Langway Capitals jersey.
Yeah, Dave, I think I'd go retro.
Yeah, retro.
I like the 1980s jersey.
Or you can go the 98 one that Jagr wore with the Screaming Eagle.
Yep.
Screaming Eagle would be a very fitting one for them to bring back now, given the, let's say, political climate in Washington. I think the Screaming Eagle would be very apropos right now.
I bet some of those old Caps like Peter Bondra and Michael Pavonka and Ole Kolzig were pretty happy to see the Capitals win on Thursday night.
I'm sure that they were. Once a Capital, always a Capital.
Callie Johansson.
You can keep naming old Capitals.
Joe Riki.
Okay, this is obviously what the segment's going to be now. Keep going. Do you have any more?
John Drews.
Yeah, John Drews is
Brendan Witt.
Okay.
What's his name?
Jim Hrivnak.
Jim Hrivnak, who was traded to the Winnipeg Jets in exchange for Rick Tabarachi.
Right.
Rick Tabarachi.
Number 31.
To the Capitals in exchange for Jim Hrivnak. That was a hell of a trade. Really changed the direction of both franchises.
Hrivnak played for the Jets the last year they were here. Jets 1.0, right? 95-96?
I thought it might have been before that. But I'm trying to remember who the backup goaltender to Habib Boulin would have been that season.
Don't forget about the most handsome of the Hatcher brothers, Kevin Hatcher.
Darian Hatcher played for them too, didn't he? Did he play for the Capitals too?
No, he played for Dallas.
I thought he played for the Capitals first. Anyways.
Mike Gartner,
certainly. I mean, everyone remembers him blazing around in the skills competition.
Steve Konowalczyk.
For the record, okay. Darian Hatcher played for Minnesota, then Dallas, then Philadelphia.
Okay, there you go. Thank you, David. Prove me wrong. Anyways, John Tavares. Obviously, the New York Islanders made a big move. Lou Lamoriello made a big move. He made a big move in hiring Lou Lamoriello to begin with, and then he began his shakeup of the culture, deeming that they needed a culture change in Long Island as they fired both Garth Snow and Doug Waiter. I guess to be official, they reassigned them within the organization.
By the way, were you guys surprised to hear that they're sticking around with the organization?
Well, I mean, you're paying them. You might as well get them to do something. Who knows what they're actually going to do?
I just know that if we worked for the New York Islanders organization, you two would both be fired with your beards.
No beards allowed, of course, with Lamoriello.
He would punt both of you quick. Yeah. He's clean shaven.
He's very Steinbrenner-esque in that fashion. Anyways, the firing of Waite and the firing of Snow. I was a little more surprised about the firing of Waite than I was Snow. I mean, Garth Snow, obviously, his time was up there. I thought that
Did you see the Islanders play this year, Drew?
Fair enough. But, I mean, I thought they might have given Doug Waite a little bit more of an opportunity. Obviously not. So what does this do to John Tavares and his chances of remaining a member of the New York Islanders?
I feel like, guys, my opinion changes weekly on this.
Oh, good.
At the beginning of the season...
Cover all bases, you're never going to be wrong.
Exactly. At the beginning of the season, I thought there was a good chance that John Tavares was going to stay in Long Island. But as the season progressed, Dave, the Islanders were awful this year. Let's be honest. They were one of the worst defensive teams in the league, probably have the worst goaltending in the league.
Mm-hmm.
And towards the end of the season, March, April, I was kind of thinking like, okay, this is John Tavares' last year with the Islanders. He's going to sign with another team come July 1st. Then Lou Lamoriello decides to leave the Toronto Maple Leafs. And then he says he's not going anywhere. Kyle Dubas, kind of right after he's hired as general manager, says that, okay, we're going to see what Lou Lamoriello is still going to do with this organization. Then the Islanders bring in Lamoriello as the president of hockey operations. And then a week or two later, he relieves Garth Snow of his duties. And as you mentioned, Doug Waite is no longer going to be the head coach. So obviously, first and foremost, Lou Lamoriello has to hire a head coach. And there's some names out there, Sheldon Keefe, Scott Stevens, who obviously, was there with him in New Jersey. We'll find out, I would imagine, in the next week or two who the head coach is going to be. I don't think he's going to wait till July to hire a head coach, but we'll see. As far as Tavares goes, Lou Lamoriello is making a pretty clear statement here. He's the man. Things are going to change here.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that the Islanders, Dave, are going to bring in a goaltender. I mean, whether that's Philip Grubauer, whether that's another goaltender, They're not going into next year with Thomas Greiss and Jaro Halak. They just, the goaltending has to be addressed.
They've tried that for too many years now, and they got, and they managed to get a playoff berth out of it. But I mean,
they're going to have to bring in more help, though. Yeah. I mean, you know, they made the trade for Jordan Eberle last year. Jordan Eberle was actually really good for the Islanders, and I think they've still got a lot of good young talent there. But you're going to have to be aggressive, whether that's in the trade market or via free agency. You're going to have to bring in other players to surround John Tavares. Anders Lee's a great player. Josh Bailey's a great player. We mentioned Eberle. Andrew Ladd's there. I mean, you've got some good players, but this is not a Stanley Cup contender right now. So Lou Lamoriello has some work to do. I think now the chances of Tavares staying are better just simply because Lamoriello, I think, can possibly have a bigger impact on keeping him there than Garth Snow would have had.
I think Garth Snow's time was clear that John Tavares was done with Garth Snow.
Yep.
I mean, the fact Garth Snow was able to remain as a general manager for over a decade with what I'll describe as a very middling track record.
He won one playoff round.
Yeah, a very middling.
In 12 years or whatever.
A middling track record at best. This Islanders team, though, I mean, if they're able to hold on to Tavares, you look at them, they have two first-round picks.
Yep.
Their own and the one from Calgary. So those are both
12 and 13, right?
Yeah, pretty decent first-round picks. They have two second-round picks. They have a lot of draft capital that they can certainly use to maybe not make an instantaneous fix, but to certainly acquire quality pieces, assuming they draft properly. There's reason for optimism if they're able to keep Tavares under contract.
The problem is, though, is that you're basing it on what could potentially happen. So if you're John Tavares and you're thinking to yourself, I can sign this contract and win myself a Stanley Cup potentially in the next few years.
Sure.
Or do I have to put in for another 5 years of rebuild? And if you're a younger, or not that young anymore, but if you're a younger player like Tavares who's hungry and wants to have success, not just individually, but as a collective team by winning the Stanley Cup, you may be thinking, I could make the money and have a chance to be on a team that's going to be a contender faster than the Islanders. Now, we've heard about John Tavares and how loyal he is.
Yep.
And how loyalty is a big thing. And we know the Islanders they invested a ton of money in their practice facility. It's absolutely, I saw the video last year. It's a spectacular facility. But the problem is, there's a lot of uncertainty. I mean, sure, you brought in Lou Lamoriello, but it doesn't fix all. It's just, it's one aspect of the team that you're improving upon, but it doesn't necessarily give you a GM, doesn't give you a coach. And so there are question marks. And if you're John Tavares, again, to me, you're sitting there, you're thinking to yourself, well, do I want the uncertainty or do I want something that looks closer to what I think is going to put me into a position for success?
The other player, I can't believe I forgot to mention
Matthew Barzal.
Exactly. Matthew Barzal, he's going to win the Calder Trophy. He had a phenomenal rookie season, former member of the Seattle Thunderbirds. I mean, up the middle, you got Tavares and Barzal up the middle. Brock Nelson is your third-line center, and you've got some other nice pieces there. You know,
it starts on the back end and it starts in goal.
Right, and that's why I think if you're Lou Lamoriello, to Dave's point, you're not selling John Tavares on a rebuild and we're going to build through the draft and we're going to be a good team 3 or 4 years from now. You're saying, okay, look, we've got some good players here. Yeah. I'm going to make a trade. I'm going to bring in another defenseman. I'm going to sign a goalie. And he can't guarantee a Stanley Cup this year, but he's saying we're going to be better. We're going to be, at the very least, a playoff team this year. And as we build on what we already have, we're going to compete for a Stanley Cup within 2 or 3 years. This is a team that is in win-now mode.
Head coach.
They have to be.
Let's talk about the head coach then. We know that obviously Doug Weight is out. Is this Barry Trotz's job if he wants it?
Well, we don't even know if Barry Trotz is leaving Washington.
Well, but I think Michael, in the previous segment, Michael Trakos, when he joined us, had some pretty good points about it does seem like that whatever happened behind the scenes in Washington, he said it wouldn't surprise him in the least bit if Trotz leaves Washington now as a result of whatever happened in the past that they decide that they can't remedy that situation. Or that Barry Trotz says, I don't want to necessarily remedy that situation. Trotz is in a position now where he's got all the power, he's got all the leverage, he just won a Stanley Cup. He's probably considered right now one of the top three head coaches in the entire NHL, given his history of regular season and now playoff success. He can call his shot.
I think there are a lot of coaches that would love that job. What about Dave Tippett?
Well,
what about Alain Vigneault?
Or does Lou Lamoriello go with Sheldon Keefe, who is the head coach of the AHL's Toronto Marlies. They're playing in the Calder Cup final right now against the Texas Stars. I believe game five is tonight.
Yeah, it's 2-2.
2-2, there you go. Game five of the... I mean, Sheldon Keefe, is this his opportunity to get an NHL head coaching job after a great deal of success with the Toronto Marlies organization?
He's done a great job with the Marlies, but you know, Drew, just as well as I do, he's never been an NHL head coach.
Right.
And that's not to say that he won't be a head coach in the NHL one day, but, I mean, if I'm Lou Lamoriello, I'm seriously looking at whether it's Barry Trotz or Dave Tippett or, we mentioned, Alain Vigneault, he's looking for a job. There's some good coaches out there. Daryl Sutter.
Yeah, there's definitely some good coaches out there. It's just a matter of what angle does Lou Lamoriello decide to take? And does, you know, if Barry Trotz ends up leaving Washington, boy, that changes probably the dynamic of the head coaching availability. He rockets probably to the top of any head coaching discussion there is in the league.
Larry Robinson's another name that was thrown out there. He was the coach, of course, of the Devils, the team that won the Cup in 2000.
Right.
He hasn't been a head coach in a while, but that's the connection between Robinson and Lamoriello there. He's another guy that's been thrown out there. We mentioned Scott Stevens, but again, Scott Stevens has been an assistant coach at the NHL level, but never a head coach.
Well,
so
if Barry Trotz knocks on your door and says, I'd like to be your head coach, I think you probably just say, yes, here's your $7 million a year and sign it.
Yeah, but if you're Barry Trotz, again, the question of uncertainty. Right, within the Islanders' framework. So, I mean, do you want to go there and start from scratch? Maybe, I would suspect an established coach would want to go into a position where he knows he's going to have success.
You almost wonder if the Islanders or Barry Trotz specifically waits until after July 1st to see if Tavares signs, and then, well, hell, that's a much more appealing job.
Because if you're Barry Trotz, you're not signing with the New York Islanders without John Tavares there.
Probably not. And if you're Lou Lamoriello, you're maybe approaching a different head coach depending on if your team is young and rebuilding with behind Matthew Barzal versus with Tavares in tow. And then, you know, Barry Trotz is more appealing versus a Sheldon Keefe or something
along
those lines.
Should mention, boys, Arthur Staple, of course, writes for The Athletic, mentioned that even if Scott Stevens isn't named the head coach, he expects him to either be an assistant coach or involved with the organization in some capacity just because of the long-standing ties between Lamoriello and Stevens.
Kalen Addison is expected to be drafted at the upcoming NHL draft. He's a defenseman for the Lethbridge Hurricanes, originally from Brandon, Manitoba. He's going to join us next. We'll talk to Kalen about his junior career, talk about what he's feeling 2 weeks or so away from the upcoming NHL draft, where he expects to hear his name announced in Dallas. That's up next. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.